Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests, and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
I, like a lot of advocates, don't have this urgency to go back to normal, because normal in many ways wasn't great for our disability community. And I think we've learned a lot of lessons that I don't want to just, forego applying because we're all interested in getting back to things. So,
hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans. And today we're delighted to bring you episode 117, Vaccine Equity and Disability Rights. There's mounting evidence that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD, are experiencing more severe COVID-19 outcomes than the general population. An early study using real-time electronic medical record data reported that people with IDD had a higher rate of diseases in addition to COVID, and that these comorbidities, as they are known, are associated with more severe COVID-19 outcomes. What we're talking about are things like respiratory diseases, nutritional and metabolic diseases, and circulatory diseases. These people also had a higher case fatality rate of ages 0 to 17 years and 18 to 74 years. A second study using data for New York State reported that the COVID-19 case rate was 4 times higher and the case fatality rate 1.9 times higher for people with IDD living in residential group homes than for the state overall. And then a more recent study used data from California and reported that the COVID-19 outcomes for people with IDD varied by residential setting, with higher case rates in settings with more residents and higher case fatality rates in settings providing skilled nursing care. My organization, the Hogg Foundation, has already gone on record that vaccination is a golden opportunity to address longstanding issues of equity and injustice. And our guest, Kara Ayers, is here with us to help us explore just how true that is for people with disabilities. She's Associate Director of the University of Cincinnati Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities and the co-founder of the Disabled Parenting Project. She joins us remotely from Cincinnati, Ohio. Kara, how's it going? We are so glad that you're able to join us today.
Going really well. Thank you, Ike, for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Okay, so if you're like most of the guests who I interview, you probably wear a multitude of hats. So I thought that we would get underway by just first, talking a little bit about your background and how all of the different hats are worn. So maybe just some of the high points of your personal or your professional trajectory. Leading up to you being here with us today.
Yeah, sure. Well, I am trained as a clinical psychologist, and as I pursued my PhD, I think I envisioned, a more traditional path of seeing patients as a psychologist. But at that time, I was also very passionate and always have been about disabled rights. And I'm a proud disabled woman myself. I have osteogenesis imperfecta and use a wheelchair for mobility. And so at that point, throughout my PhD career, I was balancing advocacy work with my studies and my clinical rotations. And so as I graduated and defended my dissertation, which was actually research based on growing up with a disability and how that impacts one's psychosocial development, I started to realize that these two interests could merge in terms of my interest in psychology, which I've always seen as the way that we get along with the world and with each other and you know, trying to optimize that, and then my interest in disability and inclusion. So I was able to merge those once I found about the Association of University Centers on Disability, AUCD, which is our umbrella organization of where USEDs are. So as you said in my intro, my USED is at the University of Cincinnati, and actually sit at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. That's where we're technically located, but as you might imagine, things have looked different the last almost year and a half. So I've been working from home for a number of months, but really doing the same work that I did before, just plus a lot of COVID-related work. So I have the good fortune to do research, to do writing, to do teaching. I mentor other disabled researchers, helping to, you know, boost them, because we're definitely historically excluded. And yeah, so I love my job because I get to do so many different things. It's never the same every day. And while it's challenging, I feel like we are moving the needle on disability rights. And so that keeps me going every day.
Before getting to any of my heavy questions, I would just like to know how you're doing. You know, what is your world looking like now compared to, you know, 15 months ago?
Yeah, better now than it was a few months ago. I am extremely thankful to be vaccinated. I'm high risk should I acquire COVID. My lungs have a harder time fighting off infections, respiratory infections, as does my husband, who has the same condition. So I had a lot of sleepless nights worried about what would happen if one or both of us got sick and what would happen. We have three kids. And so I'm a fairly high anxiety person anyways, somewhat related to my disability. So my, you know, my condition is I can break bones easily, and sometimes something could cause a fracture, sometimes it might not. So it's kind of the recipe for creating anxiety. And so I'm already a pretty anxious person, and adding COVID on top of that really was difficult for a number of months. I think the next step that we're waiting for our family is the children to be able to be vaccinated. My oldest is 14 and he is fully vaccinated, but my two youngest daughters are not. So, you know, we are still largely masking in public unless we're outdoors and spaced out pretty well. And so some things look the same, other things, you know, have gotten better, but my perspective has definitely changed, you know, since pre-COVID in terms of what priorities I have. And I'm definitely committed to taking some of these lessons learned and not just losing them. I like a lot of advocates, don't have this urgency to go back to normal, because normal in many ways wasn't great for our disability community. And I think we've learned a lot of lessons that I don't want to just, you know, forego applying because we're all interested in getting back to things. So that's kind of where I am right now, I think, but thanks for asking.
So just to get us anchored, what do you think are the most important things that our listeners should understand about what disabled Americans have experienced during this pandemic? So let's perhaps start with just COVID in general, and then let's talk about vaccination, if we could.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's been a lot, a lot of different impacts. And interestingly, you know, I was just reading through a study that came out recently that looked at around 150 people with physical disabilities. And they actually found, this researchers found that people with physical, that the people surveyed with physical disabilities had fared better, meaning that they reported less negative impacts by the isolation caused by COVID. And they reported higher instances of coping strategies that they'd used to adapt to the isolation caused by COVID, or resilience. And in the commentary of this study were the real takeaways. And they pointed out that this study doesn't mean that COVID didn't impact people with, in this case, physical disabilities. When you looked through the interviews, you saw that in many cases, these individuals were already highly isolated. So actually the title of this study was Already on Lockdown, indicating that there were already transportation barriers that were in place, or just feeling excluded from the community in many ways that kept many people with disabilities isolated pre-COVID. So when you try to look at, like, in this small sample size, you know, what role COVID has, it was interesting because you were also able to see some strengths in it. And I've seen some of these in my family. I mean, we were already quite adept at things like grocery pickup or delivery because that was a much more accessible option for us. And as we saw more of those options open in our community, like curbside pickup or where they bring the food out to you from the restaurant instead of having to unload everything and go in, all of those, you know, were welcome signs because they were universally designed to be more accessible. Of course, that's not, you know, why we put those in place. We put those in place for, you know, attempts to reduce infection related to COVID. But I think that it's interesting because the disability community has demonstrated some strength and, of course, resilience throughout this, but it hasn't mitigated the impacts of, you know, I'm thinking of the direct support provider crisis that was already in place that was exacerbated. I've had friends that in the midst of the pandemic, their caregivers stopped showing up. And of course, you can understand it from multiple perspectives, right? You can understand it from the need to stay safe for both the individual with the disability and the caregiver who may be going into multiple homes. But there's no safety net for our caregiver programs in our country in terms of how are those persons' basic activities of daily living, their basic needs, bathing, eating, getting in and out of bed, met when your caregiver just stops showing up. I think one of the harder to document, but still very impactful was also this dialogue that society started having and in many ways didn't stop having that, you know, only the sick or the old would die. And so, first of all, we now know that that's not true, very inaccurate, but just the impact of hearing so many people be fine with that or see that as a reasonable expenditure during this pandemic, when we also knew that there were things we could do to prevent loss of life. So I think that for many of us, including myself, is a deep wound that will take, I'm not sure what amount of time or what to heal. It's a very deep sense of distrust in that it's, you know, I've heard some people describe it as saying the quiet part out loud. So it wasn't a surprise that the disabled life was so devalued, but it was pretty hurtful, especially to see people maybe through social media that you knew, sometimes loved ones or friends, family members, that would make comments like, you know, we got to get on with it. You know, unfortunately, it might make some people really sick, but they were probably sick already. And so to see that callousness in our society is has definitely been hurtful. So I think that kind of sticking with the COVID realm, and if we move to vaccines, just the frustration of that, unlike COVID, we had months and months to prepare for the vaccine rollout. So it was doubly frustrating when states, you know, come December 2020, seemed like they again didn't remember, you know, the needs that people with disabilities would have to access the vaccine. And although it seemed like society was clear that people who were sick or people with disabilities were more likely to die from COVID, it's like it didn't connect that they too would be prioritized to get a vaccine. So one of the projects that I worked on in collaboration with the Center for Dignity and Healthcare for People with Disabilities, which I direct, and then Johns Hopkins has a disability health research center. So our teams worked together and we created a dashboard that allowed people to see, depending on their state, what groups they were prioritized in, how their state even defined disability, because it varied state by state. So we tried to assist in kind of making sense of a lot of confusing messages. We had to update this dashboard. Our team was only able to update it fully, all 50 states, weekly, but realistically we could have done it daily because that's how quickly and how frequently this information was changing. So you can think about just the amount of confusion. And, you know, we continue to troubleshoot vaccine access. I spoke to someone yesterday who needs in-home vaccination because she's unable to leave her home, but she also has a really significant needle phobia. And so she needs somebody that would be you know, professionally skilled in helping her through that. So we're continuing to figure out how to get more people with disabilities vaccinated.
What does the research tell us about, you know, the degree of vaccine uptake on the part of those with IDD? And what crucial factors can influence the numbers in either a positive or a negative direction?
Excellent questions. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we don't have a clear picture because we haven't done a very good job of gathering disability data in the whole picture of vaccination. So as an example, I mean, even myself, I qualified for the vaccine in my state based on my employment type before I did as a person with a high risk disability. So if you look in my state, I wouldn't even be counted among those who have a high risk disability that are vaccinated. And, you know, I'm just one of thousands and thousands of examples. But most states, the data that they have, they looked at individuals with IDD who are registered with their state developmental disability services. And within that data, we see fairly good uptake rates. And I don't have an exact percentage, but just in comparison, we see often slightly higher than your typical general public rate. So that could cause us to get happy, you know, feel excited that our messaging of the need for this vaccine is going through. But I would encourage us to pause on that because this isn't even half of the picture. So approximately 20 to 25% of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities in any state are tied to their DDS or developmental disability services program. So while some of the research shows us that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are directly invited from their developmental disabilities services system are accepting the vaccine more often than not. So some of the rates cited are 60%, 70%, which is around the ballpark of what we're aiming for. And it, at least in my state of Ohio, is higher than the general population. But the problem is that it's only a small window of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So only about 20 to 25% of people are connected to their state developmental disability system. And so, you know, and a lot of state policy leaders don't understand that disconnect. So you heard some Department of Health officials celebrating, we've vaccinated, you know, 70% of people with disabilities in this state. And that's not accurate because we're not collecting data effectively to know how many people you vaccinated. And again, that group that you directly reached out to with IDD only represents a small fraction of the actual full developmentally or developmental disability community in the state. So we still have a lot of work to do. And I'd say positives, people seem to be motivated that if they get their vaccine, they're more protected so they can get back to things like their jobs and visiting friends. Many people are motivated by not needing to wear a mask anymore now that they're vaccinated. I'd say negatives, challenges are barriers to vaccination sites themselves have been a problem. People have had some transportation troubles getting there. For some people, the crowded kind of max vaccination sites have been not feasible. Also, we know that, like all of us, the people in the lives of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities often play a role in whether they feel confident in getting the vaccine or not. So unfortunately, direct support providers have had very low acceptance rates. And so, again, unfortunately, the vaccine has been politicized in many areas. So if you have areas where there's low vaccination rates overall, many times, people with disabilities are also unvaccinated in that area for potentially the same reasons that other people are choosing not to get the vaccine in that area. So we still have a lot of work to do.
When it comes to vaccinations, are there some simple best practices vaccination sites follow to make the experience as accessible as possible? And what are like the best and worst examples that are out there?
Yeah. I think for many people with disabilities, knowing what to expect is really helpful. So our Center for Dignity developed a social story in December, which was an interesting time to develop it because it was actually right before the vaccines rolled out. So we were trying to guess, like, what will this experience be like for people? We didn't know at that point, will we go to a doctor's office to get the vaccine? And, you know, we've since learned that that has not usually been the case, although many people with disabilities feel more comfortable with that, according to some of the research. So I am happy that now, with some more flexibility as the vaccine proliferates out, it will eventually probably be an option that someone, if they felt more comfortable getting it at their doctor's office, would be more likely to be able to do that. So things like social stories, being able to ask questions to know what to expect. Of course, things like, you know, a vaccine site that you can get into if you're a wheelchair user, you know, there was a lot of, I feel like, missed opportunities to provide some pretty basic accommodations. Like, there were long lines in a lot of sites and they didn't have any places where people could sit. So people who maybe used canes or walkers really had trouble standing in those long lines. So again, these are things that if you involve people with disabilities in your planning process, a lot of times they can help you foresee some of these challenges and troubleshoot them in pretty basic ways. I mean, having a few more chairs or benches is not, you know, overly costly or challenging. So best practices, I think, have been examples of where people have met the needs of communities. So in some cases, they've brought the vaccines to communities. So they have, you know, shorter distances to travel. They may, you know, be able to be in line with their neighbor. All of it feels safer and we can, you know, we can make what we can predictable. Also spreading lots of accurate information about what to expect. So we know now to expect, you know, many people do have a sore arm after. Some people may feel some side effects, but those go away in a couple of days. And so again, knowing what to expect. And then I'd say on the negative side, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of those examples of people just being very rigid. A blind individual who contacted me because she had taken an Uber to one of these max vaccination sites, but it was more than an hour long wait expected in the car. And so she got out and went to one of the people facilitating the vaccination site and explained her situation and was told, you know, sorry, no exceptions. You have to wait however long. So, you know, of course she couldn't pay that long to be in the Uber. So she ended up going back home without her vaccination. And since then, you know, interestingly, Uber is now offering, Uber and Lyft are offering free rides. This was before that. And also I hope we've got more education to the vaccination sites that they should be flexible and expect some things like this, because people with disabilities are trying to do their best to problem solve and troubleshoot on their end, which in this case was about getting to the vaccination site. And so we have to be met with that same flexibility and equity approach. And, you know, equity is not the same for everyone. It's consideration of everybody's different needs. And so that's really what we need the vaccination sites to do as well. And we see that need continue. You know, we're still working to get people, especially who are not able to leave their homes, vaccinated. And in some cases, towns are able to do this with such low frequency, like maybe one a day, that we still have individuals who have a vaccination appointment, but it's in August. So that is frustrating, I think, because not only is that a long time to wait, but that's risk every single day until that vaccine. So we're still chipping away, I think, at the effort to vaccinate more people with disabilities.
Okay, so in one of your previous responses, you alluded to I guess what we could say is the troubles that you've been having trusting those who it seems just want to get back to the way things were, and really being able to return to a world where they didn't really have to give much thought to people whose situations were different from theirs, you know, much less, you know, people with disabilities. And so my last question is that, you know, you have long experience as a disability rights advocate, you know, predating COVID. So right before the pandemic started, you gave a talk titled Disabled Parenting in an Ableist World. What will be different about your activism or about your outlook as a result of having gone through COVID, or not different at all? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating question that I think about a lot without realizing I'm thinking about it a lot, I think. I am hoping to heal in some ways, in that I know that, and I want to, and I want my children to know that there are so many caring and, you know, thoughtful people in this world that are willing to pitch in and help others and be understanding of other people's needs. I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where they don't trust anybody and think that largely people are looking out for their own best interests. But there definitely have been parts of this pandemic where our family has struggled with that, in terms of, you know, at times it felt like such a small thing to wear a mask. And we live in an area where there's been a lot of controversy about mask wearing. My kids were in a small minority of kids that did virtual school this year. The majority of their friends and classmates over the year were full-time in school. So there was a lot of guilt for me as a parent, in that they were missing out on so much, not only learning, but their friends. And a lot of that was for the safety of our family and the longevity of our family. And I'd never been in that position, either as a disability advocate or as a parent, feeling like I'm taking something from them. But I'm really proud of the way that I feel like we've emerged from this, in recognizing that we've spent a lot of time together. And we've given each other grace in that time. And we've realized that it's not only about taking care of just our needs and making sure we're safe. We also feel a sense of pride that we've done what we could during this hard time to make sure other people are safe. And so we have had hard conversations about, we can't control what somebody chooses to do. And sometimes that means that we couldn't participate in whatever that was. There were definitely activities that my kids had done for years that chose to open, you know, at the height of the pandemic with no masks, and we had to opt out. And so I think all of those lessons I can apply to my advocacy work, in terms of realizing what you can and what you can't control, keeping your own health, whether it be mental health or physical health, in mind at all times, but also persevering through. I mean, the pandemic is not over, despite what it feels like in at least my area. But so far, as of today, you know, we have made it to this point, and we've achieved a lot along the way. So I hope we just keep that trajectory and that momentum, and keep healing as a society as well, because we've had a lot of loss, and we all need to recover and heal in many ways.
Right. It's still unfolding what exactly healing will look like. I have a sense that there really is no normal to go back to, that we've learned entirely too much about one another, and sometimes in a very unflattering light, unfortunately. And re-knitting the social fabric, it's just going to be a struggle. I wish you luck in the struggle, and I'm
thank you. I wish you the same.
I'm glad that we have you in it. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and talk to us. And
thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation. I welcome, you know, your listeners, if they have questions or they want to reach out. I think part of our healing is conversations like this. So thank you so much. And yeah, I encourage your listeners, if they're on Twitter, they can reach me at Dr. Kara, K-A-R-A, Ayers, A-Y-E-R-S. I wish us all luck in the healing from here.
This is the second episode we've done on vaccination. In episode 113, there was a consensus on the part of our guests that vaccine acceptance largely comes down to engendering trust, and that the common framing around vaccine hesitancy is not always helpful to the cause. Here is one of our guests driving that point home.
There's a lot of language out there about kind of myth busting and misconceptions. And Melanie and I had many conversations about how, you know, you're kind of communicating to the audience like that you're wrong, you know? And people have valid concerns. And what we're seeing from polling figures is that some top concerns are just practical ones, like I'm afraid I'm going to miss work from the vaccine, right? And we are not getting, there's not enough messages getting out there that, like, you know, you're likely to feel bad second day, second dose, or like depending on the vaccine that you received. So like there is actual just information needs out there, practical ones. And so we were kind of wanting to try to kind of address that. So we were thinking about positive ways to make it more positive and giving like more of the benefit of the doubt and validating concerns. Because there is a history of issues with vaccines and with certain populations. So we're trying to be very kind of inclusive in how we message this so that we could be the most understanding about this. At the same time, to your point on vaccine curiosity, this is kind of like meant to be an antidote for fear, which, you know, there is a lot that like knowledge and curiosity can help with that, right? We want people to not feel overwhelmed, but more kind of give them buckets of like, is your concern this? Is your concern this? So they can start to articulate on their own and hopefully give them something interesting to engage with. We're hoping to kind of provoke their own innate curiosity to learn more if we can give them something they haven't thought of before. So that's kind of what kind of keeps us focused and inspired around a curiosity model to keep it positive.
That was Chelsea Brass from episode 113, Vaccine Equity and Trust. Chelsea is a communication studies doctoral student and co-developer of the Vaccine Curiosity Tool, designed to help resolve uncertainty about the COVID-19 vaccine. In this episode, we're presented with a pair of possible alternatives to the vaccine hesitancy framing: vaccine equity and vaccine curiosity. If you want to know why they matter, you'll have to check out the episode. You can find a link in the show description for this episode wherever you find it. And that does it for this episode. We're glad you could join us. If you have comments or anything that you would like to share about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Really good comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. Production assistance by Anna Harris, Veronica Rodriguez, and Julia Sufrin. And as always, thank you to the Hogg Foundation for its support. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. You can find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Thanks for joining us.